At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Receiving this message.
We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
Entry 415.jm0124. Certificate number 25935. Immigrants.
You're in a desert, walking along in the sand when all of a sudden...
Is this the test now?
Yes. You're in a desert, walking along in the sand when all of a sudden you look...
What one?
What?
What desert?
Doesn't make any difference. What desert is completely hypothetical.
But how come I'd be there?
Maybe you're fed up. Maybe you want to be by yourself. Who knows?
What would you say this funny character voice is that you're doing? Just out of curiosity. Is that...
I haven't done this in a while. I'm auditioning for the Jeopardy announcer job.
I see. This is your radio voice.
Welcome to Jeopardy.
What if you were like a character, like a Wolfman Jack kind of announcer?
Hey, welcome to Omnibus.
Here's the host of Wheel of Fortune, Ryan Seacrest.
I did want to be a DJ. In high school, that was one of the jobs I imagined for myself. Maybe I'll be a DJ.
And we should explain to people that meant something very different then. I want to be a DJ.
Right. I was not trying to remix records and put on crazy drops that would get everybody in Ibiza, hopping at
it's
4
DJ
in the morning.
It's DJ J-Rod.
No, I went around my senior year in high school to all of the rock radio stations in Anchorage and submitted my application to be a DJ in training. And got no response except laughter.
That's the hinge on which your life turns.
That's right.
You decided to become an introspective indie rocker as a result of that humiliation.
Well, no. The one thing I did was I went to the, as I've probably described before, the UHF, brand new UHF television station playing 24-hour music videos and submitted my application there to the program director, Richard Hadley.
With whom you kept up a... correspondence, I remember this.
And who is a regular Omnibus listener and futureling, Richard Hadley, my old boss. And I went in and sat in the lobby of that building every day for weeks until he finally came out and said, I will never, ever, ever give you a job. But if I do give you a job and you ever skip school, I will fire you. And that's how I knew I had a job.
Is he still a follower of yours because he feels like he's invested in your career, like he's created you and he wants to see what kind of Frankenstein or benevolent Dalai Lama figure you've become?
Maybe, although he is a Midwesterner who's interested in ephemera and takes pictures of old, ghost signs on the sides of brick buildings in the Midwest.
We need people to do that.
But he's in that sense, he's right in the target audience for Omnibus because we have, so many Midwestern listeners who are like, that's my town that you're talking
about.
No
one listening here has never taken a picture of a faded Coca-Cola sign. Literally everyone within the sound of my voice knows.
But Richard has just recently, I think, gone to and actually displayed his photographs at some kind of art event, his photographs of old, buy this kind of wheat flour, like ghost advertisements.
Are you going to tell him, I will never buy one of your prints, but if I do, and I find out that it is not an authentic flour mill advertisement.
That's right. I want it to be one of 20, not one of 50.
Now, we've done omnibus entries for Richard Hadley and others before about personality typing and testing. We covered the Myers-Briggs test, I believe.
Yes, we've talked about several of them.
And we've done omnibus entries about different kinds of New Age mystics and gurus.
Lots of those.
Right? We did the... Who's the person in Yelm who thinks they were Shirley MacLaine or they were Ram Dass?
Yeah,
or
it's Ramtha.
Lothar of the Hill People. Ramtha.
But we've also, I mean...
Think about
all the cults we've covered.
Siberian mystics and early American frontier cults and... But this is our chance to combine our two great interests, personality typing and New Age woo.
I can't wait. You know, we say woo and then people get mad. Because...
Well, I could have said wackadoodlery, and I said woo, because it's less pejorative.
Well, but the people that subscribe to woo are like, well, if you don't like woo, then it just means there's something dead inside you.
Well, they should just burn some sage and settle down.
That's right.
I think they'll feel better. I mean, they can, if they want to get back at me, they can rub a piece of topaz really hard, and that'll show me, I think. Is this going to calm them down? Any other stuff I'm saying?
Rub a piece of topaz.
I just think all of their kinds of revenge will be perfect because it will soothe them and is extremely unlikely to affect my destiny.
The thing is, I don't think there's been enough studies to indicate whether or not rubbing some topaz under a pyramid constructed of copper plumbing might energize that topaz and actually be able to reach you at your home on Lopez Island.
And what if they don't even have... They haven't even constructed such a pyramid. It's just the natural occult geometries of the plumbing in their house.
Oh.
Happens to have all the resonances required to beam.
It's like a Faraday cage made of plumbing.
And it'll beam that energy at me and change my destiny forever.
You are my density.
Do you believe? I mean, let's just go back to personality typing.
We can just start with no.
Are you a solid no on anything I'm about to say?
No, I mean, no. Basically, I have no beliefs.
No, I think you might be a yes here. Like, do you believe in the human personality? Like that by adulthood, is your observation of human nature such that by adulthood, people are kind of who they are, and not only can you tell kind of the kind of person they are and the kind of things they're going to do, but also you feel like you can kind of group them into this kind of person and that kind of person?
You know, within limits, yeah, I do think that. And yeah. I think, you know, rhetorically, absolutely. It's and maybe it's important as human beings just to organize our world.
Yeah, I mean, our cerebrums are going to make us do that.
Yeah.
It's going to make us see categories. And sometimes they are helpful and sometimes they are illusory, but it's the only way for us to understand the world.
Yeah, unfortunately, the kind of proliferation of pop psychology tends to mean that we group people according to half-understood ideas of pathologies.
This is what we will be discussing today.
Yeah, so it's like, oh, that person's a bipolar, and it's like, well, that actually is a thing, and not just everybody that acts weird around you has a personality disorder.
Yeah.
And I think these days that some neuroatypicality has actually become kind of a point of pride for people, then it turns out that your disorder then becomes kind of defining and in a way like a way you think of yourself. I feel like all of that is a little bit of a slippery slope. But I definitely would say like, oh, there's this kind of actor and that kind of actor.
I am seeing a lot of widespread cultural recognition now that we have reached a point where if everyone can use therapy speak, then some are going to wield it well and some are not. Like some are going to use it to work on their own mental health, and other people, you know, are just going to do what they always did, but now with new jargon. And I've even seen pushback to the idea that we should be saying things like, oh, I have bipolar, or, you know, don't say I'm depressed if you don't have depression. I saw somebody get mad at somebody for saying I'm addicted to chocolate. You are not addicted to chocolate. Addiction is a serious problem, and it really raises my hackles when I hear someone say,
"Yeah,
you've heard all these discussions."
That whole thing, I feel like, cannot burn to the ground fast enough.
The ship has sailed.
I notice it a lot because, you know, my style of engagement, my sense of humor is very much related to, like, I'm going to tell you a real story of something that's real, and this actually matters to me. But I'm going to also acknowledge that it is absurd by kind of exaggerating its absurdity. And it is possible for a thing to both matter to you and also for you to recognize that it's absurd that it matters to you. Right?
I feel like storytellers know this.
This is crucial to
narrative.
Right? But that in the current world, those two ideas kind of can't coexist. So every time I post something online where I go, you know, where I'm acknowledging, like, people are online complaining about United Airlines, that is intrinsically absurd. And yet you can be authentically frustrated and furious at United Airlines. All those things.
Those are valid emotions. In fact, it's probably weird if you're not angry at United Airlines right now.
Right. And the problem is if you don't recognize it's kind of absurd.
Right.
And there are a lot of people that are like, well, So what happens is you'll post something and inevitably you get five or six people that are like, you have no right to be, you know, this is a first world problem, or this is a white privilege problem. You know, there's all this kind of pushback on the very idea that you would have a problem.
I have a lengthy disclaimer I just put before everything I post online. Uh-huh. It's got a lot of fine print and it includes things like
three or four tweets in advance of any tweet.
The speaker acknowledges that all these problems are first world problems, that they are filtered through his own lived experience only and may not accord with every element of yours.
Right.
And so every time I say anything online, I post a GIF of this boilerplate.
And then
I post a pithy observation.
Yeah. But for me, the desire to analyze other people according to, like, a very narrow, weird little template of what is possibly wrong with you. Like, I have watched you interact online for a long time, and I've never once seen you go into someone else's thread and tell them what's wrong with their observation, right? Like, it's not a thing I do either. I don't go into someone else's comments and say, you know what's wrong with you?
Usually they do that to me.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, look, buddy, the gloves are off.
Yeah, that's right. And I do that too. If you come at me, I'm going to be like, you know what your mom said? But the idea of, like, spending time online, going around saying,
finding a stranger and entering a conversation.
Yeah, do you know what's wrong with you based on the one pithy observation I just read? Here's the mental disorder that you suffer from. That is the kind of weaponization of psychology that does us all a disservice.
And you could see it used for any kind of nefarious purpose. Like this week, we're recording this at a time when award-nominated Hollywood actor used therapy speak to kind of gaslight and abuse his girlfriend publicly.
I guess I must not have been online. See, I don't know what you're talking about.
You have the bliss of knowing nothing about this.
Not on Twitter anymore. No idea what you're referring to. So, wait a minute. You're telling me a Hollywood actor used therapy speak inappropriately to gaslight people?
Hard to believe that an actor would.
I'm just trying to get this all together
would,
in my
would
head.
Would mistreat a woman?
No. And then trying to slide out of her DMs with
It was a significant other, and he was trying to paint himself as the person
who was abused.
Well, the person, you know, making the sensible boundaries and, you know, just needing to perform the self-care of gaslighting his own girlfriend.
I see. The self-care. Okay. Sure.
It's self-care to isolate and gaslight your significant other in an abusive relationship.
I get it.
Anyway, that's neither here nor
there.
You
seem to have taken sides. Not having read anything about it, I'm blissfully floating above it.
There's only one side. You don't know. The Twitter narrative is, here's the good person, and here's the evil person.
Yes.
And even the good person's irrelevant. You really just want to know who the evil person is.
Yes, and how they're evil.
I guess we should also say that the brain's tendency to group people into easy to process categories is also at the root of all stereotyping, including the kinds that lead to harmful prejudices.
Right.
And I don't see that discussed a lot when we when a employment seminar or a self-help guru tells me about the five kinds of X there are.
Well, that's true. You never say, like, I'm a NSFW and...
And the W is for white.
Well, like, everyone develops pride of combination.
There is pride of combination.
Right? Yeah. Like, I'm an NSFW, and that means that you can't show me to your boss at work, and that's rad, two thumbs up. But you never do look at those and go, well, some of these personality types...
Which are the good ones?
You're kind of describing some people that are in prison right now.
Well, for the system to work, there cannot be good ones. Basically, they have to be all good ones.
All good.
All 12 signs of the zodiac
are equally great.
Just amazing, amazing, sparkling kinds of people.
Even though Scorpios tend to end up in the electric chair.
Yeah, even, but somehow you're still allowed to say things online like, well, of course I wouldn't do that. She's a Libra, you know?
Yeah.
But no, the undercurrent of, you know, that's somebody weaponizing
well,
it.
Well, this is one of the interesting things about neuroatypicality, because it's okay to say, I don't always understand human signals. Like, it's kind of a point of pride. Yeah. Like, I'm sorry, I don't understand facial expressions, or I don't understand... you know, like some of the nuances of human communication.
Here, I'll say the bad thing. Oh, you don't have empathy. Got it.
But the
and you don't say that.
Yeah, but the flip side is when that person then reports, like, well, I was really offended by this situation. You don't then turn around and go, is it possible that it was the fact that you don't understand the nuances of human communication? Right. Like, there has to also be the other side of that.
So. All of this, but I do kind of in general believe that people do have these baked in coping strategies, at least by, I don't know how much is nature and how much is nurture and what time in your life it firms up.
Who are you? What's your personality?
Well, when it comes to Enneagrams, I took a abbreviated version of the RHETI, the Ready, Riso Hudson Enneagram Type Indicator this morning.
Okay. Just this morning. So we're not talking about you all the time. We're talking about you today.
Well, that's one thing. That's an interesting factor when you look at these personality typing things, how much is actually permanent and predictive. The Enneagram, it's funny because now that this is a broad kind of self-help movement that overlaps with employment and religion and all kinds of, you know, and personal actualization. It has taken on kind of a cult-like level where followers of believers of Enneagrams will actually refer to it as the Enneagram of Personality, which is a picture. An Enneagram is a nine-sided
lighthouse shape. Made of dreams.
Wait, is nine the correct number?
No.
Oh, that's what I thought. You want a heptagram of personality, right? Ennea is the Greek for nine, like nana, like nonagon or nonillion. That's Latin for nine, nonuplets.
Now, wait a minute. The Enneagram graphic, which I don't believe I've ever seen before, looks very suspiciously like a pentagram of Satan.
It has more points, which means maybe you can get more devil power.
It's double Satan.
Maybe you get other devils like Moloch or Belial.
So it's not a pentagram. It's a nonagon or nonogram.
But again,
an enneagram.
Because we're using it's confusing because in most cases, the numeric prefix is the same from Greek to Latin, like octa, right. Deca. Sometimes there's small differences like sexa, hexa, septa, hepta. But in the case of nine, the Greeks had Ennea, like, and we still have the word Ennead, meaning a group of nine.
Right.
Have you ever had or used that word?
No. No.
I think
enema, which
that is unrelated.
Oh,
yeah. Do you have to do it nine times? Nine times a day.
If you really want to get flushed,
I guess enneagenous is a word, a flower with nine stamens. So
that was my nickname in college.
Rarely used for humans because there's really no part of our genitals that we ever have nine of that I could think of.
No, that's true. But you can be active enough that that other people feel like you must have nine of them.
I see. The Enneagram is, it's as you point out, it's pentagram-like. It's inscribed in a circle, but 9 points on the outside of the circle. So I guess that would be a 40-degree intervals, are labeled from 1 to 9.
But weirdly, why does it not connect at the bottom? Is it some kind of continue, or is it like a...
You'd think. So if you have nine, if you were inscribing triangles or you know, lines inside a circle of 9 points, surely you would do three equilateral triangles, right?
Yeah, yeah,
that's right. That's what any right-thinking person would do.
As a graphic artist.
But the cultists who follow the Enneagram of personality are aware...
You're tipping your hand a little, sir.
What do you mean? They could be good cultists, like people who like House of the Dragon.
The band of the cult.
They are... the numbers 3, 6, and 9 do form an equilateral triangle, but if you look closely... The other numbers...
don't even really have to look closely.
They don't form a triangle.
No, they don't. They just bounce around.
Each number is connected to two others, and it does have bilateral symmetry, but there's a gap at the bottom. It's kind of like a Canadian maple leaf.
Yeah, it kind of lets the water out of it.
Between 4 and 5.
If condensation collects inside the circle, it has a drain hole.
The idea is that each point on the outside of this circle, the Enneagram, represents a different type of personality. Should we walk through the nine? You probably know people like all of these.
Let's walk through the nine.
Type one is a perfectionist.
Wait, my thing here says type one is a performer or a reformer.
Where are you?
Well, I'm on some Enneagram. Are they all different?
We could have got to that later, but yes, as this is diffused into the culture.
Sorry to jump around.
As it's diffused into the culture, yeah, I think everybody wants to have their own take on what the Enneagram means and how it applies, because then you can write a book or give a seminar and charge for it.
Sure, I see.
If all you're doing is repeating the received wisdom of the original Enneagram proponents, that's not a profit center.
My goodness, there are so many of them. This one also uses the colors of the rainbow. It has words on the outside of the circle indicating different centers.
I think there's also a desire to add complexity because, you know, there's these two opposing drives. Like when you assign somebody an astrological sign or an Enneagram personality type.
What's your sign?
I'm a Gemini, of course.
Oh, sure.
Classic Gemini.
You know, I'm a liberal man. I'm sorry. I am that.
You are a liberal man, but when were you born?
I'm also a Virgo man. And Virgo men, very different from Virgo women, Ken.
How so?
I don't know. Well, you have to know us believe us.
You kind of had to be there.
Yeah.
No, I'm the same way. Like if you ask me what it is about, what's notorious about Gemini or what about me is Gemini like, I would have no idea. But people like to be assigned to these categories because there's a sense of home and belonging and recognition. I'm not alone. I have these traits in common with my fellow Sagittarius. But there's an opposing problem, which is that you've just said that you are not a unique, special little snowflake, that fully 1/12 of the human race
busted
shares all these qualities.
Oh, that sucks. And I don't want to be one of those.
And that's when a system tends to generate what you're seeing, these colored arrows,
right?
These different shades. In astrology, you have cusps or different planets that could affect the star sign you were born in, so all the subtlety or detail you want is there, depending on if you're the kind of person that wants to drill down into uniqueness.
Yeah, sure, of course. Well, like any horoscope, you go, well, that doesn't apply to me, and then the person goes, oh, but that's because you're...
That's right. Well, of course,
because your moon is in Sagittarius, it means you're the opposite of what I was saying you were.
The Enneagram, you know, in addition to getting assigned to one of the nine dots on the outside of the circle, the lines in the circle that connect you to other points, as we've pointed out, not always the ones you would predict, but to two other points on the circle, those are different kinds of relationships, different thinkers. We'll refer to them as growth lines or stress lines. The one, you know, different integrations or disintegrations, you know, various interpretations and complexities are possible. And the dots to the side of you are your wings, the equivalent of an astrological cusp. So you could be a 9 with an 8 wing. You know, you're leaning 8. The idea being that, I guess, similar types and traits might be adjacent on the circle.
So the enthusiast is connected both to the reformer and the investigator.
So I'm looking at a list. So informer and enthusiast do seem to be standard on most lists. I think the most standard list... has perfectionist as type one, principled, conscientious, organized, responsible. Number two, the helper, intuitive, empathetic, people-pleasing. 3, the achiever, hardworking, competitive, success-oriented. 4, the individualist, sensitive, introspective, reserved. I feel like the good things are first. 5, within each category. 5, the investigator, cerebral, sensitive. These are repeats. Independent, emotionally restrained. 6, the loyalist, loyal, reliable, committed. 7, the enthusiast, adventure-seeking, optimistic. 8, the challenger, willful, tough, and independent. 9, the peacemaker, easygoing, open-minded, peaceful. What's unique to Enneagrams compared to many of these personality typings is that each one comes with a basic fear and a basic desire. In most of its implementations, there's a suggestion that these are arising out of, in psychotherapeutic terms, childhood ego fixations, that these are our deep needs. These are the primal things that explain us to ourselves.
Does this all cast back at some point and establish some Jungian or Freudian, like, if not legitimacy, then at least grounding? It does?
Before we get into the types, let's walk through the 20th century origins of Enneagrams. I mean, often its followers will point to an ancient past. You know, here's a Greek thinker who said there were 8 different types.
Sure.
8's
Ramses
close.
2.
Eight is plus or minus 1. But really, the modern Enneagram is and there's a Russian mystic that they like to point back to, but it all seems a little bit loosey-goosey until you get to the father of the Enneagram, a Bolivian thinker born in 1931 named Oscar Ichazo, who traveled quite a bit. He left Bolivia to spend time in Buenos Aires. And in Asia in particular, he ran up against Eastern traditions that opened his mind. And given his dates, born in 1931, possibly Eastern substances that opened his mind as well.
Yeah, he would have been there in the Kerouac years, although Kerouac didn't go.
Right. But yeah, 50s, 60s counterculture, beginnings of the counterculture, beginnings of psychedelic exploration. And he becomes very interested in...
He's from Bolivia, so he could have been licking toads the whole time.
He grew up, you know, there was ayahuasca on his muesli every morning. But no, but so in Asia, while as he travels the world, he becomes interested in pretty much every tradition. He loves Zen, he loves Sufism, he loves yoga, he loves the Qing, Confucianism, different strains of Buddhism, Kabbalah, all these...
female circumcision, whatever you got.
No. He's not a pure relativist. But these are new ideas that he did not get in his Western education. And he develops, he becomes what he refers to as a teacher of human development. He synthesizes all these ideas into his own school of thought, which he calls proto-analysis.
See, I should have been doing this the whole time instead of podcasting. I should have just been like writing all my cult stuff down.
And this is the doomsday clock problem. Where's the equation? There is no equation. There's vibes. And he, his theory of human development, his proto-analysis, is an explanation of how the human psyche is what it is. And he believes it can be mapped on a 9-sided figure, an enneagon, a nonagon.
That he just came up with.
Yeah. There's no, you know, you can see, you know, related ideas in Sufi mysticism and in the I Ching and so forth. But this is largely off the top of his head. There's 9 types and there's a neat geometric figure.
Would you like to know another thing that is 9 types?
Yes.
Dungeons and Dragons alignment chart.
That's true.
There are 9 alignments.
I bet if we look, we can find somebody synthesizing the Enneagram of personality with D&D alignment.
I have been diving more and more into D&D alignments and I feel like it explains everything.
Yeah, that's one of the rare good sides of the nerds kind of taking over popular culture is when there is a good idea that was confined to a very deep nerd silo or remote nerd ghetto, it actually does find the popular appreciation it deserves. And now everybody can tell you which American cities correspond to which D&D alignments.
I feel like you are lawful neutral.
That's probably true. Like I aspire to lawful good.
Yeah.
And I can totally see it in my kids. I have a chaotic good kid and I have a lawful neutral kid. And, but again, you wonder to what degree is knowing the classification system changing your perception, right?
I mean, I feel like you trend to lawful good It's just you're right over the line into lawful neutral. That's what the D&D alignment chart doesn't do, is talk about gradation.
You don't have cusps and wings.
Because I'm very chaotic good, and my daughter is like lawful neutral, and we're increasingly like coming into some chaotic good versus lawful neutral conflict.
She's also entering her teens, which, does alignment change? Like,
well, that's what we've been talking
about. Can someone briefly become chaotic good or chaotic neutral in their... when they hit 13?
I've been talking to her about it a lot because I'm like, you don't know what your alignment really is yet. Believe me, this sounds crazy, but this is my new trip. Because she used to, like a year ago, she was like, I'd be in Slytherin. And I'm like, really? You want to commit to Slytherin? And she's like, I mean, not all the time.
She's a rule follower. That just seems aspirational. Like me naturally being lawful neutral, but preferring otherwise.
Slytherin is lawful evil. And she's like, well, but, you know, there are advantages. And I'm like, there are not advantages to being lawful evil for anyone other than the lawful evil.
I think that's what they're thinking.
Yeah, that's right.
It's for narcissists.
That's very much my chaotic good sensibility. But anyway, moving on. That's the nine-sided die of this universe.
Is a nine-sided die a thing? How do you don't roll up alignments.
A seven-sided die.
You don't roll up alignments.
No.
You just choose.
You choose an alignment because you feel it in your soul.
Is that the only such D&D thing?
Well,
or can you say I'm a bard or whatever?
No, I think you get to say you're a bard.
It's just like real life.
For your type.
Well, in real life, you can pick your job to a degree, but not really your ethical alignment.
Yeah, you don't roll for your race either.
Oh.
Right? If you're like, I want to be a half orc, nobody's like, the four-sided die says that you have to be a...
Well, it's interesting because in real life, you can't choose your race. You can choose your
kid's race,
career type to a degree. In 1971, Oscar Ichazo winds up in the town of Arica, the city of Arica, Chile, where he founds the Arica School to propound his theories of proto-analysis. And apparently he's a convincing and charismatic teacher because people begin to come for him from all over the globe, including American thinkers. You know, this is now 1971, and you can be an Ivy League educated person, maybe now on a psychology faculty somewhere, and still go hang out with Castaneda in the desert.
So does he have family money? Generally, if you start a weird culty school in South America, it's because somebody at least bankrolled the first.
That's an interesting question. I mean, he does begin producing manuals that he copyrights and charges. So, you know, you pay to go to his school.
Right.
It's true there's a bootstrap problem where you're like, how do you convince the first slumming guy from Berkeley to come to Arica, Chile?
You know, getting things copyrighted isn't free either.
Yeah, maybe in Chile.
Publishing your first... your first tome takes a little startup.
What
cash.
I'm saying is, I think the followers are paying for the privilege of his wisdom.
Got it.
It's one of these.
Yeah. What
outfits.
Kind of cult would it be if they didn't?
It wouldn't be a very good cult. It wouldn't last that long. And eventually, he's successful enough that he starts schools all over the world, including in the U.S. And he winds up in New York. Interestingly, just to jump to the end of Ichazo's story, an environmental kind of activist writer, new age guy, I think named Mark Sheehan, I think, who he knows from New York, persuades him to move to Maui, of all places.
Hello.
And he spends the last few years of his life living in Kihei, Maui, like where you have spent long...
Where I live.
Where you have spent long weeks.
Kihei. I'm sure I would know within a block or two of where his house was.
You may have run into him on the beach point. He died in March 2020.
Whoa!
A month which makes you wonder if this 80-year-old guy is dying, or 90-year-old guy is dying of COVID, although... I think Hawaii maybe did not have COVID deaths in mid-March 2020. It would have been later.
When did I, you know, mid-March 2020, I was not in Hawaii, as most of us were not, because we couldn't go.
You would have been trapped there.
Yeah. That would have been one of the rare marches I wasn't in, Kihei.
You could have gone to his funeral.
Or otherwise. Maybe I'm the reason he died, not going to Maui.
And I don't think there was any recognition that, like, Mr. Enneagram, the guy who created this now culture-wide business personality religion self-help movement was just living somewhere in Kihei.
I mean, did he die in poverty and obscurity?
I don't think so.
He died in wealth and obscurity?
He was comfortable enough to live in New York and then move to Maui.
Yeah.
So I don't know what he was charging for each peak at his next level of his Enneagram manual, but it's
but he wasn't sitting crisscross applesauce in Maui and people were pilgrimaging.
No, he appears to have kind of been a little bit off the grid. In 1971, the same year that he founded that Arica school in Chile, another man, a Chilean-born psychiatrist named Claudio Naranjo, who is on a six-month pilgrimage around the world, I think he's American-educated, stops in at the Arica school and listens to Ichazo's teachings. And Naranjo, having an advanced psychiatric degree, recognizes that, each of these nine personality types he's talking about, the perfectionist, the helper, and so on, they each have a basic fear and a basic desire, and they each have a basic way of responding to stress. This is part of Ichazo's theory, that when the going gets tough, this is how an individualist acts, this is how an enthusiast acts, and this is how you can really see, when the chips are down, what type is which. And Naranjo is intrigued because to him, each of these stress responses he's looking at, how each person reacts under stress actually corresponds with a disorder, a DSM disorder.
Sure. And its extreme.
Yeah. He thinks, there's a psychoanalytic backdrop for this theory. That this guy appears to, he's now teaching very authoritatively, but he seems to have kind of
stumbled into,
yes, from his own combination of Kabbalah and I Ching and all the rest, Sufism. But he may have come across something that actually has backing. And so Naranjo's extremely interested. And he returns to where he's currently making his home, Berkeley, and immediately joins some other like-minded folks at a place called Esalen at Big Sur and begins teaching Enneagrams, this nine type personality system.
So weird. I'm
to his pupils at Esalen.
I'm well aware of Esalen and have even some family connections, and had no idea that it was the font of Enneagram.
Well, I don't think that's what Esalen is well known for.
No.
But while this guy was there, he was developing Enneagram theory. It was, I'm sure the outgrowth of Esalen is
right.
Multivariate and maybe wholly inconsistent with other parts of the outgrowth of Esalen. Yeah, I know people who
have
been
there. That's where skateboarding was invented.
It's still, do you know it's still there except for those mudslides in whatever 2019 or whatever those were? Cut it off.
Yeah.
They're all just, drinking from the jacuzzi now or something in Esalen. So in the U.S., people begin writing about this as not just a mystical strain of thought, but an academic one, one with some, whatever the low grade of academic rigor that attends psychology.
Right.
Clinical psychology.
You're showing your cards again.
I think you're the one that hates the social sciences. I'm just pandering to you. And other American and European seekers have come through the Arica school, and they come back to the U.S. really impressed with Ichazo's Enneagram system. A woman, she calls herself a teacher of intuition named Helen Palmer. Again, somebody with an Ivy League psychology degree.
Yeah, a degree in
teaching intuition.
Intuition.
I don't think they give that at Harvard. together with a man named David Daniels, they found an Enneagram Institute. Like, we're gonna propound the theory of and expand the theory of Enneagrams and do research upon it.
Did they get some copyright? Are they paying royalties at this point? Or
they are not. Okay. In 1988, Helen Palmer, and I think with a co-author, with Daniels as a co-author, but maybe just her, sells to Harper and Row a book called The Enneagram, Understanding Yourself and the Others in Your Life. And this book, it's one of these early 90s bestsellers that, propounds to, that claims to be based on an ancient system. You know, your life will be more satisfying and fulfilling because of this. If you could just apply the ancient knowledge of the Enneagram.
Sure.
And it's got a confusing sounding word, but it comes with a very appealing geometric picture.
So it's connected now to actual psychiatry in one direction.
Yes.
What is the actual connection to the ancient wisdom of the pyramids? Is there like a corresponding sort of, hey, you know what? This lines up with the legend of the Jedi.
I think most of the claims you will hear about this in a self-help book will be pretty vague, and we'll talk about
the secret.
And we'll talk about, but you know, they'll specifically talk about Eastern traditions like Sufi mysticism, for example.
Sure.
But they're not going to cite their sources. They're not going to say which Sufi thinkers when thought that there were 9 personality types, because I think you will not actually come across anything very close to that idea. So the ancient foundation is pretty spurious.
I see.
But you're asking if Helen Palmer had permission from Ichaso to turn his Arika school thinking into a
best-selling book.
Publishing empire. And the answer is no. He did not. And in fact, in 1992, he sued Helen Palmer and Harper and Row, saying that she had just taken stuff from his copyrighted manuals from his classes, and you can't do that. And it goes all the way to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which agrees with Ichaso's lawyers that there are many parts of the book that are straight lifts from...
That fall somewhere between ancient wisdom...
And a thing I invented. A thing I started teaching in Chile in 1971. Now, for the purposes of this lawsuit, let's not think about the ancient teachings of Pythagoras so much. But the court does say that they find that it's fair use, that Helen Palmer, by transforming his founding principles into a self-help movement, you know, because all these people are just gilding the lily with new little implementations of the Enneagram.
Sure. Tom Petty can't write a song that goes G, C, D without having copped it from somewhere.
That is the musical equivalent. Yeah. You can think of one in your own, you know, if you're an NBA slam dunk guy, you can think about how you can't get away from doing something similar to the behind the back dunk that
right.
Dominique Wilkins did in the 1992 contest or whatever.
Exactly the analogy I was going to make.
But you went Tom Petty instead?
Yeah.
But your second was going to be Dominique Wilkins? So Helen Palmer now has the right to propound Enneagrams everywhere. And the fact that this book is coming out, she founds, in 1988, she and Daniels found a group, this nonprofit to study Enneagrams. In 1994, there's at Stanford University, there's a big conference of how Enneagrams might work.
Esselin had a real Stanford tie-in. It was all Stanford people plus Hunter S. Thompson.
But not all the Stanford people, right?
No, like, that's right.
You know, some of them were actually doing science and not mushrooms, but some of them were doing both, I think. Some of them were doing social sciences and mushrooms.
If we could take Stanford and calculate all of their contributions to modern society, including all of their negative, all the negative numbers, boy, maybe we would have been better off without them.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a harsh take for the...
If you could go back to 1930 and just...
The Harvard of the West.
Just erase Stanford. Who knows?
We want to hear from Stanford graduates. Make your case. Defend the Stanford footprint on American life. A real watershed moment for Enneagrams comes in 1995. There's a Franciscan friar named Richard Rohr, who I think also visited Arica, Chile back in the day.
Were Enneagrams, were they a hit right away?
Yeah, the Harper and Row book sells well. I mean, I'm not as aware of it as I am of other self-help books at that time. Like, if you ask me, is this the secret? I would say absolutely not.
No, you know? it was all the other ones, right? But this was the era of businesses trying to figure out how to efficiently direct resources based on whether your employees are pencil stealers or not.
Yeah, so businesses are interested in personality typing. It helps them hire or not prospective employees. It helps them place them in the right places. Employees are interested as well because it helps with vocational selection. You know, guidance counselors are now giving younger and younger kids personality typing style tests.
Sure.
To reveal what your aptitudes might be.
Would a pumpkin colored sweater go with your blue eyes? These are all questions.
And so the business community takes note of Enneagrams, and it's today it's very easy to find any number of seminars, both for business owners and people in organizations and job seekers to talk about how the power of the Enneagram will unlock their organization's potential to get more out of their people or your potential to do better within your organization. You know, like any appealing idea, it can get co-opted by any number of people. And this Franciscan friar actually wrote a book called The Enneagram, A Christian Perspective. And it's actually become a popular kind of church basement seminar now, increasingly in evangelical circles, which, you know, as you know, there's a lot of gatekeeping both in American Catholic and Protestant practice of like, we can't let in these new agey ideas. We can't let in the Dungeons and Dragons alignment chart.
Right.
Because this is how Satan despoils the purity of the Christian gospel.
Yeah, if there was any truth to it, it would have been revealed a long time ago.
So there certainly are evangelicals pushing back and saying, you know, don't believe the hype about Enneagrams. This is a subtle subtle tool of the devil. Yeah, they play that clip and then they say it. They play a sample of it, probably while they're talking. But in general, I think as we've seen in a number of ways, American right-wing Christians less picky than they've ever been.
Wow, that's
that's the Trump 2024 campaign slogan.
Finally, a little diversity.
Less picky than they've ever been. And that includes, you know, bring it all.
It's a big tent, Ken.
Yeah, and you've got somebody coming through selling books about, you know, how you'll be a better follower of Jesus if you just understand your Enneagram type.
Just understand that the earth is flat and that aliens live under the polar ice cap.
It's a little less pernicious than that, but it really is more like, I really understand how I can serve God now that I know that I'm concerned with clearly defined roles and structure, alliance to beliefs and groups, responsible, protective, anxious, and suspicion. But I do struggle with fear and paranoia because I'm type 6, the loyalist. You know, it's these things are broad enough that you can,
yeah,
you can find scriptural backing for them, just as you can find business or academic backing for them.
Does it line up in any way with ENFPs and FTWEs and all that stuff?
Well, that's the interesting question. Once you have a new system like this, particularly one with New Age roots,
yeah,
like this one does, you know, where you can't even say, yeah, the University of Minnesota put their heads together and now we've got an equation.
No, it's somebody with a degree in intuition that
it's a Bolivian guy in the desert.
Stole an idea from a guy licking toads.
Because he went to Tibet for 2 weeks on one of those Indiana Jones planes. You know, are these ideas that are going to line up with, I mean, there's the big question, like, is this the answer? Is this the single comprehensive model of personality?
That's what I am asking. Is this the answer?
And I think all these personality tests would say no, particularly this kind of woo one. But there's kind of a more limited one, which is, well, okay, even if this is not the way, proponents would say yes, this sums up the most important breadth of humanity and shows our potential.
And do they take any side in the question of nature versus nurture? Is there a sense that this is all innate or is it like a spirit world thing?
I think the post-Naranjo version of it does have the pseudoscientific backing of, you know, a Freudian or Jungian framework of, well, here are the childhood, I guess more Freudian, these are the childhood ego fixations that lead to these coping mechanisms and therefore. So I think there is some sense of...
But if you were spanked as opposed to somebody who wasn't spanked, is that going to change your Enneagram?
It depends on if it's a woman doing it when you're 3 or a woman doing it when you're 23, I think. Those turn into two different Enneagrams.
You're changing my Enneagram just by talking about it.
These are... But, you know, the question can be, is this actually explanatory or predictive in any way? Like, is there any rigor where you could do research on someone's Enneagram? Before we get into that question, would you like to know your Enneagram?
Well, I'm sitting and looking at the questions here. Let me put this to you. It is important that other people like me. Would you say that was an accurate description of me or an inaccurate one? It is important to me that other people like me. How would you answer that if you were answering for me?
So I'm typing you. So this does happen in the Enneagram world. It's been found that the most accurate findings come from a combination of a person self-reporting their own answers to questions and a skilled practitioner who can know the person well, you know, interview them extensively, and then assign them a type. And you get your best results when you do both. So me having observed you closely for years.
It is important to me that other people like me.
I would say yes to you on that.
But and like on a scale of 1 to 5.
Oh, are you looking at a 1 to 5?
At a 1 to 5 here.
There are so many accurate questionnaires. Inaccurate. In addition to the RHETI, and you have to pay $20 for a lot of them. So I took an abbreviated form of the RHETI so as not to pay my $12. But there's also the IEQ9, the Quick Enneagram Sorting Test or Quest, the Wagner Inventory, the Cohen-Palmer, the Zinkel Inventory. These are the...
Well, the Cohen-Palmer.
These are the end-of-the-world outcomes in war games, I think. Uh-huh.
Cohen-Palmer stood up in front of the UN with a baggie of powder.
Oh, no, it's the Zinkel Inventory.
So wait, now I'm looking at a very...
So I did a series of yes-no questions.
Oh, okay. And so what did it turn out that you are?
It kind of hedges. I had my highest scores in 3, 6, and 7. And
the achiever, the loyalist, and the enthusiast.
And I don't think most of those would surprise anybody who knows me. 3, for example, being the achiever, is somebody who has a need to be successful, likes the appearance of competency, image conscious, likes to think they can succeed in a broad variety of situations, and a real primal fear of letting other people, you know, disappointing others by not being able to perform. You know, I want to be valued. I want to be accepted, you know, so yeah. I will cop to that. 6, the loyalist. Values friendship and loyalty, but also tends to prepare for the worst, can be anxious and struggle with self-doubt. I can't disagree with any of that.
Yeah, but I would not call you a loyalist. That's the area where I feel
because
like
I'm insufficiently loyal to you.
Well, that, but also like I don't feel like that's like you're necessarily a core value, loyalty. I feel like that's where you tend into lawful neutral.
I'll sell people out for nothing.
But
you're disagreeing with the results of the abbreviated RHET. Yeah. Spontaneous, motivated by a need to be happy, energetic. They never want to feel any kind of emotional pain or discomfort. I love the implication that there are 8 other kinds of people that deeply want to feel emotional pain and discomfort. I mean, this thing immediately, I have a hard time suspending my disbelief the longer this goes.
The thing is, pain and discomfort for me is very seldom a thing that I actively try to avoid. I'm not afraid of pain and discomfort, and I often lean into it. So I can see where there'd be a personality type that would do anything to avoid it.
I wonder if you're the challenger.
And then other ones that are just like, yeah, pain and discomfort. Like,
I'm kind of surprised my perfectionist numbers are not a little better.
See, I would have...
But obviously, achiever and enthusiast.
If you'd asked me, I would have said achiever, enthusiast, perfectionist. And I was surprised by loyalist.
Well, again, I'm doing a very small subset of these things, and it's all yes, no. Let me give you the same 36 bullshit yes, no questions that I took.
Okay, good.
And we're going to assign you.
Okay.
And the dichotomies are insane. I've been either romantic and imaginative or pragmatic and down to earth. Exactly. Exactly. As we all know, in every situation, I'm either romantic or pragmatic.
I mean, I don't know. I feel like I'm both things, right? Would you say I was more romantic or more pragmatic?
I think I might go with, I'm going to screw with your answer here.
Oh, well, no.
First, and I'll tell you. I definitely have an answer in mind. You tell me what you're going to go
with. It was romantic and what? What was the other?
Romantic and imaginative versus pragmatic and down to earth.
I guess I'm going to say romantic and imaginative.
That's what I would have gone. And I went pragmatic and down to earth. Now, there's an open question of how fun this is for me, you, or anyone listening to this.
Go on.
I have tended
When have we ever cared about that before?
I have tended to either take on or avoid confrontations, which?
Boy, for someone with as many confrontations as I am constantly getting into, I do wish I avoided confrontations, but I get into them too much to be somebody that avoids them.
Yeah, I was going to put avoid, and then I actually remembered something yesterday where I had an odd interaction on a street corner with a guy who was ended up just kind of escalating immediately to 10 and saying, well, then what kind of effing a-hole presses the crosswalk button?
Said to you.
To me. And I think a person who avoided confrontation would be like, ooh, this person's a little crazy, and maybe I'm going to go down a block and take that crosswalk.
And instead, you pulled out a knife?
No, I just started laughing and was like, are you from Seattle, sir? Because that's an incredibly un-Seattle way to act at a crosswalk. I want to hear your story, you know?
Yeah.
And I realized that's actually me, like, not avoiding a confrontation. Like,
right.
I kind of got my back up.
So I guess in that sense, yeah, I will get into confrontation.
You're a take on.
Yeah.
I have typically been, and again, this is the false dichotomy from hell, either diplomatic, charming, and ambitious, or direct, formal, and idealistic. I like how
diplomatic. Two from column A, two from
column B. I like how diplomatic and formal are opposites. Are you diplomatic, charming, and ambitious, John, or direct, formal, and idealistic?
I think I'm charming and idealistic.
No, I have a radio button here.
I don't know. Which do you think? I think maybe
these are impossible. I'm not going to guess on everyone because it just can't be done.
It's formal,
diplomatic, charming, and ambitious,
right?
Or B, direct, formal, and idealistic.
Direct, formal, and idealistic.
Have you tended to be focused and intense, or spontaneous and fun-loving?
Can you be spontaneous and intense? Focused and intense. Well, I have no focus at all, so I guess it has to be spontaneous, although I'm not fun-loving.
I hate fun. I have been a hospitable person and have enjoyed welcoming new friends into my life, or B, a private person and have not mixed much with others.
I mean, I can't say I haven't mixed much with others.
Somewhere in the middle.
But I'm a private person.
Which way are you going to lean here?
Private.
Okay. Generally, it's been easy to get a rise out of me or difficult to get a rise out of me. Hilariously, get a rise is in quotes.
It's very easy to get a rise out of me.
It's metaphoric. I've been more of a street smart survivor or high-minded idealist.
Oh, come on. You can be both things.
These are your two core values.
Street smart survivor or high-minded idealist. I'm going to say high-minded idealist.
I have needed to show affection to people, B, preferred to maintain a certain distance with people.
Absolutely preferred to maintain a certain distance.
No question. When presented with a new experience, I've usually asked myself if it would be A, useful to me, or B, enjoyable.
A useful.
Okay. I have tended to focus too much on myself or others.
Others.
I'm myself. Others have depended on my insight and knowledge. Or strength and decisiveness?
Oh, boy, it really depends on who needs the light bulb changed, but I'm going to say insight.
I have come across as being too, I don't even have to do this one. John, have you either come across as being too unsure of yourself or too sure of yourself? Now, take a minute. But it is funny that some of these actually, you know people that are very much
right.
On one end.
No.
And others, you're like, this is crazy because everyone's both things all the time.
Yeah. I'm certainly not unsure of myself.
I have been more relationship-oriented than goal-oriented, or goal-oriented than relationship-oriented.
Man, neither thing at all.
Yeah, three.
let's see. Goal-oriented, I have no goal orientation at all. So
it's got to be relationship.
Relationship.
Relationships by default.
Yeah.
I will tell all the people in your life. The Roderick family motto, relationships by default. I have A, not been able to speak up for myself very well, or B, been outspoken. I've said what others wished they had the nerve to say.
Oh my God, that's so terrible, but I'm going to say the latter.
It's the latter, yeah. It has been difficult for me to A, stop considering alternatives and do something definite, or B, take it easy and be more flexible, which is difficult for you.
A is very difficult for me.
I have tended to be hesitant and procrastinating, or bold and domineering.
Okay. Hesitant and procrastinating, or bold and hesitant and procrastinating.
Yeah.
Is what I
mean. That's consistent with your previous, it's hard for me to stop considering alternatives. But when I took this, I actually thought,
you're pretty bold.
Yeah, my challenge is to take it easy and be more flexible, but I still did the hesitant and procrastinating thing because I do actually...
Well, you consider a lot.
I do hedge and, I have a hard time.
But you're bolder than I am.
But I'm always thinking about the road not taken.
You are, but you do choose.
Do you feel like you
don't choose?
You just don't choose.
I mean, I'm sitting here right now with a leg that needs to be amputated because I couldn't decide which doctor to go to.
That is actually not a hypothetical. If people have listened to Roderick on the Line at this point, and maybe they know that you're not just doing a bit there. Either my reluctance to get too involved has gotten me into trouble with people, or my eagerness to have people depend on me has gotten me into trouble with them. I can't even parse this.
Yeah.
So is it a reluctance to get too involved or an eagerness to have people depend on you?
I am reluctant to get involved.
Usually I have been either A, able to put my feelings aside to get the job done, or B, I needed to work through my feelings before I could act.
Well, I've never done either thing. work through my feelings before I can act, or put my feelings aside. I put my feelings aside.
Okay. Generally, I have been methodical and cautious, or adventurous and taken risks.
Come on. You can be both all of those. Methodical and cautious, or adventurous and taking risks.
Well, at least these are opposites, unlike formal and diplomatic, or whatever that third one was.
I have been adventurous and taken risks far more than I have been methodical and cautious.
I have tended to be either a supportive giving person who enjoys the company of others, or a serious reserved person who likes discussing issues. How are those the opposite?
Like, not,
but... hey, do you like the company of others, or do you like discussing issues presumably with pets or chatbots?
I have to say the latter, just because I do prefer discussing issues.
Than just buddy-buddy?
But I would like to be in a room full of people.
But to discuss
who are
the
also
issues.
Discussing. Yeah.
I have often felt the need to be, A, be a pillar of strength, or B, perform perfectly.
Pillar of strength.
I've typically been interested in either asking tough questions and maintaining my independence, or maintaining my stability and peace of mind.
The former.
I've been too hard-nosed and skeptical, or soft-hearted and sentimental. This one's very easy for me. I feel like one of my main weaknesses is that I'm too hard-nosed and skeptical. I push against that in much of my life.
No, I see why you would say that.
Do you feel like you are too soft-hearted and sentimental?
Well, I am much more soft-hearted and sentimental than I seem, and I don't know if I would regard it as a problem.
Yeah, it does say too much.
But I am much more soft-hearted and soft-hearted than I am hard-nosed.
Okay, I'll pick that one. I'm often worried that I'm missing out on something better, or if I let down my guard, someone will take advantage of me.
Oh, I'm missing out on something better if you have to choose.
My habit of being standoffish has annoyed people, or telling people what to do has annoyed people. How do you annoy people, John, by being standoffish or telling them what to do?
By being standoffish.
Usually when troubles have gotten to me, I have A, been able to tune them out, or B, you'd think the opposite would be been unable to, but in fact, it's treated myself to something I've enjoyed.
What? Either you tune out your problems, or you
treat yourself to something you've enjoyed.
Indulge in self-care.
But the second one maybe implies illegal drugs. I'm not sure what the...
If sitting in the bath with a bowl of ice cream is treating yourself...
I think you treat yourself. Yes.
I guess, yeah. But I'm not able to tune out.
I have depended upon my friends and they have known that they could depend on me, or I have not depended on people. I have done things on my own.
Oh, boy. It's uncharitable because I do love... my friends, but I feel like I do things on my own.
I mean, really, I think the reason why personality tests don't catch on with more of the population is because they're incredibly annoying to solve.
Yeah, that's right.
I have tended to be detached and preoccupied, or moody and self-absorbed.
Detached, preoccupied, moody, and self-absorbed.
Yeah, I'm a DTMS, a DPMS.
Detached and preoccupied, or moody and self-absorbed.
Yeah, clearly the opposite of detached and preoccupied.
Yeah, I mean, what would you say? I guess I'm detached and preoccupied, right?
I did that for me. Yeah. And I think, let's see.
Moody and self-absorbed.
I mean, all these, so there's a lot of research showing that the phrasing of the question, and sometimes if it's out loud, even the delivery of the attitude of the administrator really changes answers.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And I almost think that self-absorbed is so much more pejorative than anything in the other. You know, moody is on par with detached and preoccupied, but self-absorbed is really a value judgment.
It is, and you know, the thing
and
is,
who's
like,
picking that?
I think both you and I hold ourselves in high esteem. You know, neither of us are like, I suck.
Right.
But we're not...
healthy white American ego.
We're not either of us absorbed with ourselves. Like, sitting in, you know, like,
right.
Me. We're always looking out.
Yeah. I feel like we're much more fascinated by others.
Yeah. The other, I mean, I'm moody only because there's an internet. If there wasn't one, I don't know if I would even be aware of my moods.
And how does moody go with self-absorption?
Yeah. So I don't feel self-absorbed. I feel the other thing.
Detached and preoccupied.
By default.
I have liked to challenge people and shake them up, in quotes, not literally.
Sounds sucky.
Or, yeah. No, who likes that guy? I can guess. That guy's, let's see, the challenger? Who was that douchebag?
Challenge people and shake them up, or?
Comfort people and calm them down.
Oh, dear. Challenge people, shake them up. Comfort people, talk them down.
I absolutely know your answer here, and I will tell you if you're wrong.
Challenge people and shake them up. Comfort people and calm them
but
down.
You can see how the self-reporting, you're just giving your perception of your personality, which sometimes can be a self-fulfilling prophecy, but often I think people are maybe kind of in the darkest of their own.
I think my reputation is as somebody that challenges people and shakes them up, because I don't think most people, even people close to me, recognize how much time I spend comforting people and talking them down, because it's not my manner.
But what do you think your answer is?
I think challenge people and shake them up.
I think you're absolutely comfort people and calm them down.
You do.
I think you're not. Okay. I think, but I'm not going
to
change you.
No. Thank you. Thank you. It's hard for me to acknowledge that, because I think my onstage persona is like, ha ha ha. And I think people take that at face value and they don't realize how.
No, I think it's not particularly close. In social interaction, you actually, this is something Mindy told me, something my wife told me, that you are good about zeroing in on the person who needs something and providing it, actually.
Yeah.
In a situation. And I think you do it actually publicly. I think that's your podcast persona as well.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that Mindy would say that.
Well, I know you have that, but I almost think that's like your own parody of your stage affect.
Yeah.
More than it is. How it actually comes off.
You can hear in my voice that I'm shy about that. I don't know why I would be embarrassed.
Do you think it's not masculine in our culture to?
No, but I've spent so much time afraid of it and overcompensating for it by acting like a
party guy,
or like a big shouldered guy,
finger guns guy
that I'm clearly hiding something, or I don't know, embarrassed, ashamed of being a comforter.
Well, we're going to get to the root of it here.
Okay. All right. Okay.
But I didn't put comfort, actually. I've reported your own deluded, I challenge people and shake them up, because that's how this works.
Oh boy.
Science marches on. I have only six more. I have generally been a outgoing, sociable person or earnest, self-disciplined person. Not opposites.
No.
Ring a bell every time you hear two things that are not opposites.
I mean, I have to say outgoing because it's something I've trained myself to do.
Yeah.
Be outgoing and sociable is... I've worked my whole life to be that.
By the way,
it's against my nature.
I might have said this in the Myers-Briggs part, but this is exactly how the alignment and occupation stuff worked in the video game Ultima 4.
Oh.
It started with a tarot reading where somebody would give you a set of these false binaries and you'd have to make a choice. And then it's like, presto, you're a tinker. You value honor. Instead of a D&D player choosing, like, you actually, your own ethical outlook.
Yeah.
Of the player got placed into the game. I have usually A, been shy about showing my abilities, B, like to let people know what I can do well.
Oh, A.
You've been shy about showing your abilities.
Yeah.
Interesting. I feel like I'm a clear-cut B there.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Well, but that's, I mean, that's the thing. That's part of what was the thing that we were talking about that you were?
The
achiever.
Expert. Achiever, there it is.
The achiever, which I'm not.
But you like to
have achieved a certain amount.
But you like to perform, like
I do.
Like
but
you're
I,
not hiding your lights under bushels.
I guess
you haven't put out a record in 17 years.
There's that, but I feel like so much of the performance is a performance, and what I'm really trying to do is conceal what I actually can do. Because a lot of if you have watched any of my performances, you know that it's not me really trying my hardest to excel at what I'm great at.
That's generational. You can't.
Yeah, maybe
it's all Stephen Malcolm's fault.
It really is. But no, I think that what I think of as my real talents, I'm very shy about.
Mm.
In the same way, like you would not think of me as somebody that was. At a party looking for the person that was suffering and trying to seek them out and make things better. Because I'm standing on a table with a lampshade on my head. But you know, what I'm really doing
is... That's a put on.
Yeah,
you're,
right.
You're crying on the inside when you got that lampshade on your head. Pursuing my personal interests has been more important to me than having comfort and security, or having comfort and security has been more important to me than... There's got to be a better way to phrase this one.
I don't think either thing. pursuing my own interests over comfort and security.
Which is it? Personal interests, comfort, and security.
Personal interests.
When I've had conflict with others, I've A, tended to withdraw, B, rarely backed down.
Tended to withdraw.
I have A, given in too easily and let others push me around, or B, been too uncompromising and demanding with others.
I would say A.
Yeah, you were consistent with your last answer there, and I split it somehow.
Yeah.
Like I say, I rarely back down, but then for some reason, I actually feel like I give in more than I push around. I don't know. I've been appreciated for my unsinkable spirit and great sense of humor, or quiet strength and exceptional generosity.
The former.
Unsinkable spirit. Much of my success has been A, due to my talent for making a favorable impression, or B, achieved despite my lack of interest in developing interpersonal skills.
A.
All right. I think we have your answers.
Oh, wow. We're there?
I think that was not as bad as listing all the 101 dead cats. Wow. We have a clear cut. We have two categories that are well above the rest.
Really?
Oh, hey, this is another site that calls the first one the reformer instead of the perfectionist. I wonder if that's a... I wonder if the idea is the perfectionist is too pejorative and they're trying to make it more. Okay, so you are clearly a 7 or a 5. That's the enthusiast, that overlaps with me, or the investigator, the perceptive cerebral type. Alert, insightful, curious.
A 7 and a 5. Yeah. The investigator and the enthusiast were both on the yellow-orange side of the rainbow here.
Yeah, 5, 6, and 7 are what's called the head triad, revolving around thinking, or on the downside, anxiety. They're often commonly grouped into 2, 3, 4, the heart triad, revolving around emotions and primarily shame, and 8, 9, 1, which is the body triad, instinctive actions, anger, if anything.
And do I have a third? 7, 5, and
really no.
Wow,
they're all kind of bundled up. Some 1, some 3, some 4. Your lowest would be 2, the caring interpersonal helper, which is interesting because I feel like you certainly have altruistic, unselfish attitudes.
Weird. I mean, looking at them on the page, I would have said the helper, the individualist, and I don't know, the challenger. I would not have said...
Yeah, the lack of individualist is surprising.
And, I think I'm an investigator for sure, but I don't think of myself as an enthusiast at all. I don't like anything.
Yeah, I would say...
I don't get excited about your dumb record.
But here's the enthusiast, the busy, productive type. Oh, well. No. Extroverted, optimistic, versatile, and spontaneous, playful, high-spirited, practical. They can misapply their many talents.
None of those things apply to me. Not a single one.
I think some of them do. But you're right. The enthusiast kind of implies... someone whose life is appreciating and enjoying outside stuff. And you are the furthest thing from fanish.
And I would say being not a helper, are you sure you didn't mistype?
Yeah. I just put in the opposite of what you're saying every time. And then you're like, it's right. And I'm like, gotcha.
That's really strange to me because I would have picked 2, 4, and maybe 5 or 8.
Yeah, I almost think it's a question, some people probably do deceive themselves. Their self-narrative about who they are and how they operate with the world is fundamentally blinkered. And I think we know people like that.
Yeah.
And
we strive not to be that.
Right. But you don't know what kind of way, I think the idea of the questionnaire is it gets through the self-deception.
Right.
But even the proponents of the questionnaire would say, it actually needs to be done in concert with an outside observer. So
much of this is walking in with a certain amount of self-deception.
Right. I am taking a test to determine my personality.
And there are plenty of people that would sit down in front of this and just be like, what? And answer the questions with no kind of meta-analysis of like, well, what is that question asking?
Well, maybe they'll get better results because they're actually going off the cuff intuitively. Whereas you and I are like, ooh, boy, what does that say about me if I'm self-absorbed versus detached.
But you've taken enough of these tests to know not to do that.
Right.
Right? You're trying to like...
Well, none of these is the sociopath. You know, I think the idea, you know, in principle, these are all equally good. It's just telling you, hey, this is the kind of person who needs to worry about braggadocio. Whereas the good thing is they're, you know, heroic. This kind of person, you know, it gives you both a primal fear and a you know, aspiration.
Yeah, right. This is the problem with a lot of this language in the popular culture. I was saying this the other day, that the word entitlement now it has become this wonderful weapon that anyone can use against anyone, right? Yeah. Like entitlement. Oh, you have such a sense of entitlement. And it is descriptive of everyone. And so your only counter is, no, you have entitlement. But it doesn't have it has no sense of like, well, what does that translate to in terms of your action?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
A lot of people with entitlement end up being people that give a lot away or a lot to the world, right? And
you can be self-aware of your entitlement.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like I mean, that's...
Once you have it, are you meant to exorcise it from you completely, or is it something you turn into a force? I mean, what does the word even mean anymore?
Well, Enneagrams have become big enough, and I think crucially they've become used in business and corporate settings, which means they're going to get studied. Somebody's going to want to be able to point to academic work demonstrating,
of course,
like, do these results really predict anything? And there are some findings on the side of Enneagrams. There is some correlation with, you know, the standard vocational preference tests that are given to people. You know, those findings of what kind of a career you should go into, what your professional life should be, do tend to have some overlap with Enneagram types. In general, they're pretty stable over time, but that is not purely true. You know, there have been some interesting findings where there's an acquiescence bias where people will just, depending on how the test is administered, people will just agree with everything you say. And obviously this either or one is designed to get around some of that, but even there might be still some bias there, like, you know, which answer do I think is the most pleasing to the listener?
Well, like the one I'm looking at is on a scale of 1 to 5, inaccurate to accurate. And if you say a question like, I see the positive in every situation, 1 through 5, I do see the positive in every situation. It doesn't mean that I don't also see the negative.
Yeah.
So what do you answer?
Are you answering the meta question of, am I generally a rosy, optimistic person?
Right. That's kind of what it's asking.
I think I'm a 4. But then you're just going back to your own self-conception of yourself. You're not actually thinking, okay, let me think of some recent situations and see what I...
But like the next question, I am not afraid to tell someone when I think they are wrong. And I look at that and I go, well, I'm not afraid to tell them.
Yeah.
But I also don't tell them. Because
I have my own hangups about telling people when they're wrong.
Yeah, it's useless to tell most people that they're wrong. Like, what am I trying to do? Like, it's just not expedient. But I'm also not afraid. So, like, it's very hard to... And this is a completely different test than the one you just gave me.
Yeah.
But I would be answering...
As I'm saying.
3.
We got the Zinkel inventory. Like, I know, I was just 3. Thinking about what kind of psychopath 3. Is either a 1 or a 5 on any of these,
yeah, right?
Right. Like, do you want to know anybody who's like, do you ever see the positive in any situation? 1 or even 5. Like,
I think deeply about things. No. Well, I mean, yeah, of course. I mean, that's one where you go, yeah, what am I going to say? Kind of? No, you think deeply about things. Although I guess there probably are people that are like, nope, try not to.
But maybe those people don't know it. I mean,
yeah, right.
I recently met somebody who only discovered within the last year that she does not have an inner monologue or a mind's eye.
Yeah. We've talked about that. Yeah.
And she had just, she got into her 40s and then discovered a few months ago, she does not have a mind's eye and she does not have an inner monologue. And.
Well, you and I talked about the fact that you have the ability to close your eyes and visualize apple.
You don't have this.
And see the apple.
You don't have
Whereas I don't. Yeah. When I close my eyes, I see white dots.
So maybe there is like, you know, that's an argument that there is like vast inner differences between people that are being glossed over by surface niceties and by societal pressures.
Yeah.
And that maybe something like this could get to the bottom of, you know, here's how we actually get to know each other.
If you say, just describe a cow, I would close my eyes and think of
a list of bullet points.
Yeah. How to describe a cow. I do not close my eyes and see a cow and then start to describe it. And I don't know how you would begin to do, well, like you just have a,
I didn't make it appear. The cow appears.
That's the thing. But which cow?
The cow you appears.
Know, and that's the problem. So when I'm describing a cow, I'm like, well, it's a mammal. It's large.
I mean, one question about Enneagram theory is, what does it do for the person? I mean,
yeah.
I think because the proponents of it are using it as a self-help movement, which implies this isn't just an answer you get. This is the beginning of a journey.
And with the intention of improving upon your Enneagram? Is there like a, is there like a best?
I want to get to level 8. Well, I think the idea is if you don't know your Enneagram, you know, if your Enneagram actually does tell you, hey, here's how you tend to react under stress, and that correlates to a certain kind of
you can do better.
Disorder. Yeah, then you can do better.
I see.
Or if it's maybe kind of you've been living a lie, like you're in the wrong job, you're in the wrong relationship because you thought you were a achiever and you're actually a peacemaker or a challenger.
Yeah.
You don't want to see this kind of thing breaking up marriages, I guess, now I think about it.
There were quite a few of the answers or quite a few of the questions that were like, you know, you are this or that. And I'm like, well, I'm naturally this, but I've spent my whole life trying to be that.
Right. So what do I...
So I can't, yeah. You know, like what I can't lie and say I'm not.
And I'm a big believer in the second thing. Like I do fundamentally believe that I know people with different attributes, but I also believe that like you can train, harness and approve or disapprove of different sides of yourself.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm not talking about how I'm deeply closeted and have, you know, prayed that away. Like there's definitely a downside to that belief, but
I think it's a lot easier to train yourself to be social when you're not than to train yourself to be caring when you're not, right? If you really aren't interested in other people's feelings, how the hell would you begin to train yourself?
Sometimes I feel like I'm a person that doesn't have a lot of that natural, like
empathy,
like my reflex is not the empathic one, but I know and admire empathic people.
Right.
And so, you know, I don't want to act like I'm a chatbot simulating it, but I am trying to like inculcate it, cultivate it.
I mean, the thing about those feelings is they often, I mean, they're so complex that they can be debilitating. Empathy, right? When you really feel other people's pain, it can be a challenge to bear.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Boy, I'm... I'll take your word for it. But you know what I mean, right?
Yeah,
I
do.
You see qualities in the world that you admire.
Yeah, I see you do that very thing, what you're talking about. Like, empathy, I should keep that in mind.
And I often think that I should keep that in mind are the words
the
of House Jennings.
Story.
But I do feel like if there's a virtue to this kind of personality typing and maybe self-help exploration in general, it's just that even if it's all just based on made-up Sufi vibes, I mean, at least it's causing people to go through the process of, wait, what do I value? You know, maybe how am I helping others or conversely letting them down, or what parts of my potential are going untapped? I think too often, I mean, it's weird to say that a real problem with our society is that we don't think enough about ourselves.
Yeah.
But I guess there's a degree to which it's true that we don't think enough about our limitations, relationships, potential.
I mean, over the last 3 years, I have spent a lot of time saying, am I the baddie? Because I just look at circumstances and go, you know, the first time everybody on the internet's mad at you, it might just be that it's
a misunderstanding.
Yeah, it's just a bad day. The third time everybody on the internet is mad at you, maybe you need to look at what you're posting. But then when everybody on the internet is mad at you and you're fighting with both your neighbors and each one of those situations seems like a discrete issue.
I can explain.
This is a problem that I have with this individual person or this 150,000 people globally. But I can explain how we got here. Right. And it all seems to be a chain of events that makes sense. But when I look around and go, I am in too many conflicts for a guy that just wants everybody to get along and is just trying to do the best job he can. What am I missing?
I think it's good to ask that. Like,
well it is, but it's like,
But you don't have the answer yet.
I don't. And when I ask people that are close to me, like, how many times have I asked you that question in the last 2 years? And you go, oh, yes, empathy. Anyway, and I go, God damn it. But, you know, like, the people in my life don't have much they can offer. A lot of the people that are close to me are like, no, it's not you. You're great. And I go, yeah, but still, it seems like I'm not great.
I mean, it's the kind of thing where it's the kind of topic where I am reluctant to just kind of brainstorm.
Yeah, right.
You know, because a relationship can be at risk if you're like, let me just blue sky some ideas why you're a big problem. I don't know which of these are right. You tell me when I'm warm. You know, it's a little bit of a fraught interpersonal area, right?
Yeah, well, especially if somebody's like, well, you do kind of run over me all the time and you keep eating my cornflakes, even though I have a post-it note on it that says, please don't eat my cornflakes. Because somebody says that and you're like, well, no. That's not what I, but, you know, you don't want to try and defend yourself when somebody's telling you.
But we're smart enough to see the pattern.
Yeah.
Like, I was at a family reunion not that long ago where I realized I was kind of being the crusty one in a lot of interactions. And it happened enough times that I was like, I'm actually out of sorts this week. And I am like, I am duplicating the same kind of behavior that would make me roll my eyes if I saw another person do it.
Yeah.
And it made me like want to address it. Now, I never did. I never actually made any change or personal progress. Sure. I want to be very clear.
That's on those people.
The weekend ended before I could put my plan into action. But it was a moment of like, I am actually seeing a pattern in my own behavior that I don't like. And I patted myself on the back for that moment of wisdom.
a little bit of self-care. I hear back from a lot of people that I just need to let go of petty insults, or I need to, you know, I don't know what.
I have told you that.
I think. And I don't, that's one thing that looking at an Enneagram, I don't know what I would do to let go. It feels like introducing a whole different bunch of Stanford people into the conversation.
No, this is where we get you an Enneagram life coach who charges you $240 an hour to walk you through your Enneagram journey.
Yeah. How do you let go? But I mean, that doesn't explain how I got in trouble with half the world. You know, it wasn't a question of letting go.
Do you think Enneagrams need to be adapted for the social media age?
Yeah, right.
Like, I mean, I think there's some truth to that. That, like, actually, there's not a lot of correspondence between what happens to us in online personas versus how meat space people know us.
Yeah, a lot of people have said to me in the last 3 years, don't tweet. And I'm like, well, yeah.
But they didn't say, don't hang out.
Yeah, you know? Right. Or like, don't have tweetable thoughts. Like, what are you going to do with your tweetable thoughts? Because everybody around my house is like, stop tweeting at me. I'm like, I was just saying an interesting observation. That was a tweet. You just said a tweet.
Oh, I see. You found a good, healthy outlet for your tweets and they just don't want to hear it.
Well, I see somebody in a supermarket and I'm like, did you ever notice? And they're like, stop tweeting at me. I've never even met you.
That's so funny. You just walk up to somebody at the store and be like, they changed the Mission Impossible theme to 4-4 to make it easier to dance to. Sir, please. You're going to get maced.
Sir, this is a Denny's.
You're going to get maced.
And that concludes Enneagrams. Entry 415.JM0124. Certificate number 25935 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that you made it all the way through this episode where we basically just did an Enneagram test out loud.
I feel like we also discussed the history and implications of the...
You're absolutely right.
...of the trend. Give us some credit, John.
Yeah. No, we're a great podcast and...
You're too moody and self-deprecating or diplomatic or whatever.
If you want to go on social media and report what a wonderful time you had listening to this episode and all the Omnibus episodes... Be sure to like, fave, and retweet Omnibus at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Our handles were at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick. And you can email us either your brief letter saying that our lack of respect for Woo impoverishes us emotionally.
They're gonna understand. Now that we've talked through all our problems, they're going to be like,
oh, right.
It's because you don't have turquoise in your bracelet.
Yeah, but I really feel like the Enneagram results of that test are inaccurate, even though I do feel like I answered accurately. We worked it through. This was like an encounter session. I feel like we got there, but I just don't agree with the numbers.
I wonder if we just need to pay the $12 and get the full thing.
What I think what we should encourage people to do is, if you are listening and are familiar with Enneagrams, please Enneagram chart Ken and me in your perception.
You've heard 500 hours of us talking.
Yeah.
You are more qualified than anyone on earth.
Yeah.
To know what Enneagram type we are.
Tell me what Enneagram type you think I am and what type you think Ken is.
And tell me, like, if my complexion means I'm an autumn or a spring.
I think you're a spring.
Because I'm wearing, like, this thing with red dots, and, like, I don't think I should be doing that if I'm a...
No. That shirt's not working. I think you need pastel shirts, pinks and blues and yellows, but like, pastel. Not bold. Like, muted.
So I'm a spring?
I think so.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
I just saved a ton of money from my Color Me Beautiful consultant.
There you go. $200 an hour. If you want to send that stuff to us, email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. And you can go on the Futureling sites, both Facebook, there's a subreddit, there's a Discord.
Discord coming soon, apparently.
There are other places you can go and talk about Enneagrams with one another and your own personal experiences of them. You guys can all share your own Enneagram numbers, and I'm sure someone will find a way to get into a disagreement about it, but at least on our Facebook page, that disagreement will be quickly resolved because it is the friendliest place on the internet. You can also send us things. I don't know if there's any physical manifestation of Enneagrams, but for instance, if you have an ashtray from Esalen, from the 70s, you could send that to us.
Any nine-sided object could represent That's Enneagrams.
Right. A nine-sided die?
It doesn't even have to be well-designed. The Enneagram icon is not.
If you have some kind of...
Why is five, like, not connected to four? What's going on down there?
If you have a framed graphic of Dungeons & Dragons alignments, we post it here on the wall. Send that stuff to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. It looks like you've got mail over there.
Sue from Honolulu is a new listener to Omnibus. Enjoyed it so much she signed up for the Patreon.
Aloha, Sue.
And more importantly, sent us some macadamia nut shortbread.
Yay!
Confusingly, it's Big Island Candies, even though she's from Hawaii. But nothing but the best here. I'm tossing
you. She's from Hawaii, the Big Island?
She's from Honolulu. But
oh, I see. She's from Honolulu. Wait a minute. These don't have any chocolate on them. Macadamia nut
shortbread
biscuits.
They're like biscotti.
Yeah. Let's see. Are they better than the ones you get on Delta?
Well, probably. They're gonna have macadamia nuts.
Oh, those are good.
These are delicious.
Oh, those are way better.
Sue, thank you.
Oh wow, it feels like Christmas in here.
There's also this one that says John Roderick, care of Omnibus. It's not clear whether it's to open on air or not.
It's not ticking. It doesn't look like it even came in the mail. Why does this have no postage or anything?
I took it out of an envelope that said it was from maybe a used bookstore in Niagara Falls.
Care of Omnibus. Let's see what it is. Oh, there's a long letter and three books. And the books are...
Sex Manuals.
Delilah Dirk and the, variously, Turkish Lieutenant, King's Shilling, and Pillars of Hercules.
Somebody sent you their self-published romance novels?
I think this might be all sex all the time. Oh, no, wait. Oh, they're graphic novels, and almost certainly these are intended for my daughter.
I don't know what kind of a persona Delilah Dirk was. I was afraid she was some kind of a heaving bodice governess type, but no, she's going to be some butt-kicking strong female character.
She is a strong female lead. She's a sword-wielding badass of history, who has been to the Pillars of Hercules, the King's Shilling, and the Turkish Lieutenant.
She's been to the King's Shilling?
She has.
It could be a pub.
Looking at the graphics for the King's Shilling, this seems to take place in the War of 1812 era. So let's say she's an early 19th century ass-kicker, but she might also be a time traveler.
A butcher, that was my trade, but the King's Shilling is now my fee.
Wait, it's the Turkish lieutenant, and you wouldn't have said Turkish until, what, the early 20th century?
You mean because of the they would have been the Ottomans?
Yeah.
Didn't people still say the Turks for all kinds of Middle Eastern Ottoman types?
Yeah, I suppose.
I think they probably did.
I mean, the country is called Turkmenistan. Certainly they're...
Well, a country is.
Not the country. That's right. The country.
I'm still eating shortbread.
Oh, yeah, me too. And then in conclusion, please support the show with your monthly pledge at patreon.com/omnibusproject. A monthly pledge.
Yeah, we were roasting that guy for requiring money for his Enneagram manuals, but now look at us.
Yeah, that's right.
Now the chips are down.
The thing about a monthly pledge is it's really a pittance.
It's so small.
Even $200 a month is almost...
It's got to be less than your car payment.
Yeah, it's almost nothing.
And,
but,
what's more important, your car payment or my podcast?
But really, you can get in on on a monthly addenda episode, on access to all kinds of photographs and show notes and ephemera.
At our highest donation level, you can even suggest a topic for a show. And in fact, that's what happened today. Thanks, Joshua, for supporting Omnibus and suggesting we talk about the Enneagram of personality.
So go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and pledge $5 a month. That including the addenda show, that's $1 per show. And considering all the enjoyment you surely got out of today's episode, as well as every other episode.
Who else bills you at $1 an hour?
$1 an hour. No, $1 for often an hour and a half.
Whether you want it or not. Think about a car wash. How long are you in there? 5 minutes?
Barely.
What does it cost? $20?
At least.
A car wash, therefore, is like $240 an hour. And, okay. And you're not going to pay your favorite podcast $1 an hour? What kind of a monster are you?
Wow.
I mean, your car is clean, but is your soul?
Break it down.
Is your conscience? Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.